Hello, everyone. How's it going? It's good to see you all today. Some of you still getting coffee and donuts and whatnot. Can I just say that this happened right before I came out, and I just wanted to tell somebody. I slipped on a puddle of beer back there and almost fell to my death on the stairs backstage before I came out here, which just reminded me that where our church is. So it just made me, like, even though I almost died, it just kind of made me love our church. So just in case you don't know where you are, you're in a bar right now. So just quick reminder, someone just got surprised. They're like, why? Before we jump in today, I just wanted to draw your attention to something real quick, and that is all the do-over materials that you see kind of spread around. Colleen mentioned earlier, those are for our Easter service, a series that starts on Easter and goes the following 3 weeks after Easter. And please take as many of those with you as you can and invite your neighbors, coworkers, flyer cars where you work, whatever you want to do to invite folks. And the other thing I want to just make clear about that is we have two services on Easter Sunday. As you can kind of notice as you look around here, we're a pretty packed out environment. We still have people coming in, and so we want to make room for all of the folks that are going to be coming on Easter. So we're adding an 8 o'clock service to our normal 10 o'clock service as well. So I want to encourage as many of you as is possible to go to the 8 o'clock time slot, and we want to leave as many free seats as we possibly can in the 10, because folks that aren't used to coming to church usually don't get up early to do so, okay? Just being real honest with you, okay? Let's let those people sleep in. If you're bringing friends and you're meeting them here at 10, that's awesome. Save them a seat, be here. But I would encourage as many of you that can to come to the 8 o'clock service and that are normally here. If you're not bringing friends or if your friends have young kids, let's be honest, those kids woke up at 4:30 a.m., okay, ready for Easter eggs and just stoked out of their mind. And so they would love to come to an earlier time slot. And so if you could make that happen, that would be fantasmic. All right. So we're going to jump in today. We're in week three of this series, This Is How We Change the World. And we've been talking about the theology behind our methodology. So why biblically do we do things the way we do as a church? And we've just been talking through some of those different things. And so today we're going to continue on in that flow. And I want to encourage you to take notes, write down anything that kind of stands out to you or you feel like maybe as I'm speaking, God is speaking something directly to you. And so you can capture that and hopefully walk away and apply some of those things to your life. So the title of my message today is this, Calloused Compassion. Calloused Compassion. When I was 17 years old, I had this awesome car. My friends joked that it was an old man car because it was this, like, it was really boxy. It was this burgundy Chevy Cavalier, and it had burgundy interior, burgundy exterior. It was just like a big red cherry bomb. It was amazing, okay? And when I was 17, my senior year, the first semester of my senior year, I totaled that car, okay? I pulled out in front of a 10-ton plumbing van, and it hit me in the driver's side door and just completely totaled the car. And during that accident, I actually, my face was like all messed up, as some of you are like, is that your real face? I was beautiful, okay, before the car accident, and then this happened, and that's why I have to grow a beard to cover it up. So, and I broke both my kneecaps. I couldn't walk for a long time. It was a horrible situation. And I remember, like, getting to the hospital, and despite all this stuff where, just keep in mind, like, not walking ever again was on the table at this time. What I was most afraid of is that my dad would be mad about the car, okay? I was just like, oh, what's he gonna do? And then the very next thing I was afraid of, again, not the never walking again, but just like, oh, I hope he gets me another one. Right? Those are the two, because when you are a senior in high school, like, not having a car is the equivalent of never walking again in your mind, okay? Those two things are on par with one another. And so I was freaked out, and I remember laying in this hospital bed. My parents rushed over to see what was going on. They finally got there, and my dad was the first to get there, and he comes in, and he saw me, and I could tell he was, like, a little choked up of, like, you know, seeing your kid with, like, their face just covered in blood and strapped down to a thing, and just the doctor's talking to him before he gets in, and he realizes, like, how intense this is, and he gets in, and I'm just like, and I see him, then I feel bad, and I start crying, and we're both just like, and, like, facing off, father and son, both trying not to cry, failing miserably. Like, at one point, he had one of those little snot bubbles. You know when you try not to cry, and you're trying to hold it in, then it's like, whoop, and it just pops. Kind of breaks the moment up a little bit. And so I'm laying there, and I'm just like, I'm so sorry, Dad. And he's like, it's okay. And then, like, a moment goes by, and I'm just like, you're going to get me a new car, right? And my dad, like, with all the compassion he could muster in that moment, was just like, no, that's not going to happen. No. And I was like, wait, what? And he's like, no, I'm not going to buy you another car. That's not going to happen. I was like, but I'm crippled, you know? You have to, you know? I need it, and I'm hurt. You have to give me gifts, you know? Like, that was the thought in my head of, like, I need this. I want it. It's awesome. Like, that's what dads are supposed to. Just give me the car. And my dad was like, no, I'm not going to give you another car. I mean, like, if you want to get another car, then you're going to have to work for it. And, you know, and I'm like, work for it in my wheelchair. You know what I mean? Like, just using everything I have to just, like, you know, sadden my dad and force manipulate him into doing this thing. And he's just like, you're going to have to, you know, get a job and work for it. And if you pick a car out that you like, and if you're able to raise half the money, you can give it to me. And then I will go out and help you get this car. And I was just like, you are a jerk, right? Like, in my head, I'm just like, you could just give it to me, but you won't, okay? It's just that it's not that you don't have the means to, it's that you don't want to do this thing for me, and it just seems so frustrating and so ridiculous. And I'm just thinking, like, Dad, you don't know what you're doing, okay? Like, could you just admit it, all right? You clearly have no idea how this whole, I mean, I'm not even a dad, and I know that, like, you're doing it wrong. Like, you're dadding incorrectly, okay? And I don't know if you've ever kind of had that feeling before with a parent where they make a decision and you kind of think, like, it's clearly kind of the obvious decision, the right thing to do here is clearly this. And then your parent, like, just goes a different direction with it. And you're like, what? You're not allowed to do that. You can't do that. What? And you're just completely shocked by it. You kind of wonder, like, do you love me? Where's your compassion, right? And you're just frustrated about it. And you probably had that feeling before, but here's what I wonder. Have you ever had this other feeling before? This feeling of, like, you know, I feel like God doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, this thing happened to me, and I kind of thought that God, like, if he really loved me, if he's really compassionate, he would have stepped in and done this thing, but that's not what he did. He tried to do something different altogether. Like, you ask him for something, and in return, he challenges you to do something that you think is crazy. That's counterintuitive. That doesn't make any sense to you. It almost feels like it's going to take you away from the thing that you want, not toward the thing that you want. And maybe you're not even the only one that thinks that. Like, maybe your friends share your point of view, right? I remember when I wrecked my car and I was like, yeah, my dad is going to make me get a job after I learn to walk again and buy my own car. Well, half of it, which is, that's never going to happen, right? And my friends are like, your dad's a jerk. And I was like, right? I mean, don't tell him I said that, but you guys should probably talk to him, right? Get your parents to talk to him too, right? And we have those same sort of things. We vent of, like, God should have done this. He owes me this. He should have done it this way. And, I mean, we can get people on board with us on that. Of, like, he should have. You've got a raw deal. He ripped you off. That's not the way I would have done it. You're godding wrong, God. I just wonder, like, if you ever feel like there's just no way the path God is pointing you down could possibly lead you to the place you want to go. Because here's what's interesting. This kind of thing is all over the scriptures. If you look at them, especially in the sayings of Jesus, all this really complicated stuff of, like, I want to go over here, and then if you want to experience that, then you need to walk in this direction. Like, if you want to be first, then you have to be last. What? In order to keep your life, you have to lose it. If you want to be great, you should just serve everybody. If you want to experience joy, you have to learn to embrace suffering. What? If you want to get what you need, you have to learn to give what you have away. And we look at all these things and we're like, what? That's not the way, what? We have such a hard time like wrapping our mind around this sort of thing. And God, like a good father, says, trust me, you're going to end up where it is you need to end up. But you're going to have to go through this in order to get there. And I know you. This is where we're going to disagree. The process. The path. Not necessarily the destination. And I want to talk about this concept today, and I want to do so through this story in the Old Testament that I think is really particularly fascinating. It's in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 17, and if you have your Bibles, you can turn there. And if you don't have a Bible, it's more difficult to turn there. Just FYI. But we're going to put on the screens behind me. And I just want to read through this and just make some observations about kind of God's way of doing things that doesn't always make sense to us. And I want to kind of talk through this idea of calloused compassion. And so if we start in 1 Kings chapter 17, we're going to start in verse 7. And it says this. It says, then the Lord said to Elijah, go and live in the village of Zarephath, near the city of Sidon. I've instructed a widow there to feed you. And so he went to Zarephath. As he arrived at the gates of the village, he saw a widow gathering sticks, and he asked her, would you please bring me a little water in a cup? And then she was going to get it, and he called to her, bring me a bite of bread too. This, everything about this is funny to me. I love that as he approaches the city, a city with lots of people in it, he sees one woman is like, that's probably the widow. I'm going to tell her to get me some stuff, right? This doesn't say that God said, like, that's the one, or like that he discerned it. He was just like, yeah, that's a widow. You win, right? I mean, like, that's just kind of the thing. I think that's hilarious. The other thing is that, like, this is such a guy way to be, right? He's just like, hey, would you mind grabbing me a cup of water? And she's just like, oh, okay. And then he's like, hey, while you're up, I'd like some bread. Anybody's husband or kid ever pull the while you're up routine? You're like, I wasn't up until I got up to get the first thing that you asked me that I didn't want to do in the first place that you talked me into, and then I went to do it, and then you're like, while you're up. I get your manipulations. I understand what you're doing. And he pulls this trick. This is like your husband is not totally to blame. This has been happening since the Old Testament days, okay? Forever and ever. Verse 12 says this, but she said, I swear by the Lord your God that I don't have a single piece of bread in the house, and I have only a handful of flour left in the jar and a little cooking oil at the bottom of the jug. I was just gathering a few sticks to cook this last meal, and then my son and I will die. Wow, wow, like super Debbie Downer moment, right? Has this sort of thing ever happened where you like you show up somewhere and you're like in a super good mood and you're just happy about life and you're ready to have some fun and feeling positive and you got a little dance in your step and you're just like, I'm ready to party, let's get some cheesecake, right? You're just pumped, right? And then like whatever your thing is, but then like you didn't read the room before you kind of threw that out there and you kind of realized that like something bad happened right before you showed up that you weren't informed about, and now you look like the jerk, right? And you're confused, and everybody's looking at you like, what? Come on. And finally someone's like, geez, jerk, how about a little compassion? We just found out that Phil's dad got diagnosed with cancer. You're talking about cheesecake, and you're like, oh, I didn't know about that, you know? And now you feel all weird. And if you're normal, your first thought in that moment is just like, I got to get out of here, right? I mean, like, I am not in the right frame of mind to be in this setting. Like, I'm all happy and wanting to eat some cheesecake, and these people are like down, and I need to like step away, and I feel like I made it weird, and I'm super sorry, and I didn't know the context of your situation, and I don't want to come off like that. I feel so stupid. I'm just going to go, right? The thing about this story is Elijah's not really a normal person per se, okay? So he doesn't do what normal people would do. He does a really dumb thing, or at least it seems dumb at the time. And he says this, verse 13, but Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go ahead and do just what you said. You know that whole thing where you kill yourself? But make a little bit of bread for me first. Then you can use what's left to prepare a meal for yourself and your son, the one you're going to eat before you die. What an awesome guy. Just like, Can we just picture this together for a minute? Like, let's say that you are this woman. This has been the worst year of your entire life. You're poor, you have nothing, your husband died. Like, there's a famine in your country, you're running out of food, and you're like, you tend to be kind of an optimistic, cheesecake eating kind of a person, but like, it's just been tough this last year. And like, you finally come to this place where you just realize that there's just nothing you can do. Like, you've exhausted all of your options. You're at the end of your rope, and so you're just like, you know what, I'm gonna eat the last morsel of food in my house. I'm going to lay down, I'm going to hold my son, who's all that I have left, and we're going to slowly starve to death in our house. Kind of a dark moment in your world. And then, like out of nowhere, this famous prophet shows up and sees you, and you're out in your yard. And it just seems like such an amazing, miraculous moment. And he's famous for performing just impossible miracles. And you're just like, oh my gosh, he's here to save the day. That's why he's here. And then he just asks for water and food. And it's like, you're like, he's kind of a jerk. But in your head, you're just like, here's the deal. He just doesn't know the situation. He doesn't know what's going on with us. I mean, it's fine. We caught him off guard. But once we explain, like, what we've been through and how desperate it's been and how, like, much heartache we've been through and just the fam and my son and the husband and this whole deal, his heart's going to break. He's going to feel sorry for us. He's going to feel so much compassion for us. And then he's going to perform a miracle that just changes our entire lives. But then he's just like, yeah, wow, that's crazy. Definitely do the thing where you cook the meal and kill yourself, but first, like, you should give me some food because I'm super hungry, and you're the first widow I saw, so I'm just assuming you're the one, and then you can go and die. I'm going to guess that if that's you, you probably are incredibly shocked at that moment, and stunned, and disgusted, and frustrated. You got to be thinking, like, how could you even ask me that? How insensitive, how calloused could you be? And so here's my question to you. Have you ever had an experience like this? Like, maybe with like a parent or a friend or a mentor or a coach, or maybe even with God himself, where you were in a desperate situation and you finally worked up the courage to tell your story. And what you were hoping for was like compassion and validation. Was for someone to say, like, that's horrible. I don't know how you've survived this long under those conditions. Like, I can't believe that happened to you. Like, you've been through, it's not fair. But that's not what you got. I wonder if you've been in this sort of situation where you told someone your problem, but instead of doing something for you, they gave you something to do. Like, maybe you went to a parent, you know, and you told them that, you know, someone treated you unfairly, and you just kind of wanted them to say, like, that's not right, you know, and jump in your corner and, like, fight for you and, like, you know, toilet paper that bully's house or beat up that teacher for you or whatever they're going to do. But, like, they didn't do that. Instead, they ask you a question that was more like, what did you do to provoke that? Like, what's your responsibility in this situation? Like, man, how could you learn from this unfortunate experience and move forward in your life? And of course, that was probably the last thing you wanted to hear, right? Or maybe, like, you went to a mentor and you asked, like, man, hey, how can I make my wife do this? That's a horrible question to ask somebody, by the way. How can I get my husband to understand that? Like, you were looking for advice basically about how to get your own way. But, like that's not what you got. Instead, your mentor looked at you with a straight face and was like, that's interesting about them. Let's talk about your blind spot. Like, maybe your accountability here could be like maybe you need to approach her differently. Like maybe this thing isn't completely her fault. Like, maybe she was kind of forced into responding this way by the thing that you did right before that. And you decided you weren't going to be friends with that person anymore. Or maybe, like, you went to a coach or, like, a director or, like, a boss, and you're just like, hey, I'm not getting the playing time on the field that I deserve, and I'm not getting the stage time that I clearly am talented enough, and, you know, I'm not getting the promotion that everybody else seems to be like ahead of me on the list for. And you just think like, I mean, they don't even work as hard as me. They're not even as good as me. They haven't put in the effort that I have. And you expected them to like see your talent and apologize to you, but they didn't do that. Instead, they just gave you a harder workout schedule. They challenged you to learn something new, to build your skill set, to take a step backward and to work on you. Or maybe like this woman, your situation was you go to God, or in her case, like the man who represents God, and you pour out your heart and you unravel a desperate situation and explain that you're in need, but instead of immediately giving you what you're convinced you need, he asks you to give what you have to meet the needs of somebody else. And like you, this is not what she wants to hear. We hate these moments. It says in verse 14, this is Elijah talking, he says, "For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. There will always be flour and oil left in your containers until the time when the Lord sends rain and the crops go again." And so what he's saying is this. Now, I want you just to write this down today. This is a big idea. He's saying this in a nutshell. If you surrender what you have now, God will supply what you need later. If you surrender what you have now, God will supply what you need later. When it comes to your relationship with God, your job is to surrender and his job is to supply. But like we like to think that like his job is to supply and our job is to stockpile, right? God, you give to me and I tuck it away for a rainy day. You supply, I stockpile. And God's like, no, you surrender and then I supply. But then, just logic, God. If you supply and then I surrender, then I've surrendered my supply, which I won't have anymore. What then? And he's like, and then I'll supply more. And then that's the one I stockpile. No, then you surrender that one. It's okay. So how many times do I surrender before I begin the stockpiling? And then God just is quiet, right? What Elijah is actually proposing in the situation is that this woman use all the flour and the food and the oil and the water she has for him, and that if she does that somehow, miraculously, there's just going to be more for her later. Like, what he's proposing is impossible. It just sounds crazy. And here's what I wonder. Like, I wonder how long she hesitates. I wonder how long she kind of, she's like, yeah, sure. And then she goes back to her house and just stands there in the middle of her kitchen, debating about what to do next. I wonder if she thought the same thing that you're probably thinking right now about the situation. Like, that sounds like a bad trade. I'm like, so I'm going to give you something now in hopes that you're going to give me something later. But like, what if I give you what I have now and then you don't give me what I need later? Like, what about that? What if that happens? Like, what if I'm all in, but you're not all in? Like, what if I put the last of what I have on the line and you don't come through? What if I give everything, but I don't get anything? I mean, like, how could you even ask me to do this? And here's the truth. When you mistake a guarantee for a maybe, you lose patience for the process. When you mistake a guarantee for a maybe, you lose patience for the process. And let me just explain what I mean by this. I think the best way for the enemy in your life to destroy your life is to turn all of God's guarantees into maybes for you. And in fact, if you rewind human history back to the Garden of Eden, this is exactly what happens. God gives people principles and immediately they start looking for loopholes. And the enemy starts whispering to Eve. Okay, I mean, it sounded like a guarantee when God said it, but like, did he really say that? I mean, maybe your memory isn't as good as you think it is. I mean, like, are you sure you heard him right? Like, maybe that's not what he meant at all. Like, maybe there's a shortcut. Like, what if he's hiding all of the good stuff from you? Like, what if you could get everything you think you want right now without walking through any sort of growth process whatsoever, without any pain, without any risk, without any faith? I mean, what if that, like, what if God doesn't actually have your best interest at heart? What if God is trying to take advantage of you? What if you do exactly what he asks of you, and then he doesn't take care of you? What if that? I mean, you might want to relook at what you think is a guarantee, because from my point of view, I kind of feel like it's a maybe. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. Are you sure you want to wade out into those waters? I mean, you're sure that God can actually be trusted. You see, if the enemy of your soul can get you to camp out in that headspace, he can get you to give up on the growth process God is asking you to walk through in order to get to his best for you. And you'll stop before you even get started. And then what you'll do is you'll tell God that his ways don't work, when in reality, you didn't give the process enough time to do its work on you. And here's what Elijah knows. He understands a particular God guarantee, a principle at work that this widow hasn't learned yet. And it's this, that when a community decides to be generous with what they have, there always ends up being more than enough to cover what they need. When a community decides to be generous with what they have, there always ends up being more than enough to cover what they need. He knows that this is true, and it will be true in her story. And in fact, this has been true in the God story all along. If you fast forward even to the New Testament, you see the early church is practicing this and watching the principle come true for them too. And a favorite verse of our church, Acts 4:32 and 34, it says this, that all the believers, this is during the time of the early church, all of the believers were united in heart and mind, and they felt that what they owned was not their own. And so they shared everything they had. Verse 34, there were no needy people among them, because those who owned land or houses would sell them and bring the money to the apostles and give to those in need. In other words, when people gave what they had, there was always enough to cover every need. And I wonder if you ever wonder this, like, why the last bit of oil? Why the last morsel of food? Like, why the land that's been in the family for years in the book of Acts? Like, why that? Like, why the first part of every paycheck? Like, have you ever noticed that God often asks for the one thing we don't want to give him? God, you have access to everything in my life and my world. Okay, what about that? Except for that thing. I forgot to say that because you cut me off, but that one thing is off limits. If you would have just let me get that far, Lord, I would have told you that before. Secretly, I was hoping you wouldn't mention it, so. And here's the thing, like, I'll give you a hint. It's not a coincidence. God wants you to wrestle with where your trust lies, in your supply or in your supplier. And so he pits the two things against each other. God's like, oh, here you go. And we're like, oh, thank you so much. And he's like, absolutely. Now, why don't you give some of that away? And you're like, wait, what? I just got it. I mean, I need it. It makes me feel safe when I have it, okay? And God's like, no, you don't need it. You need me. And I'll prove it to you. And you're like, oh, good. I thought you were going to ask me to do this without proof. No, I would never do that. Just surrender what you have now, and I'll supply what you need later. Proof. And we're like, I don't want to do that. How about you give me more first, and then I'll trust you with what I already had before you gave me extra. And God's like, it doesn't really work like that. I'm trying to get you to trust me, your supplier, more than your current supply. That's the goal here. That's what we're trying to do. And we're just like, God, I trust you. I just trust this other thing more. And that's usually the moment where you're like, yeah, I heard it when I said it. Sorry. I get what's going on here now. And then we just run and hide in a cave somewhere. In verse 16, it says this. So she did exactly as Elijah said. And she and Elijah and her family continued to eat for many days. Verse 16, there was always enough flour and olive oil left in all the containers, just as the Lord had promised Elijah. And they lived happily ever after. Doesn't it kind of sound like that? Just everything comes together perfectly. I think it's interesting. Like, notice that she didn't have what she needed until she surrendered what she already had. Like, I just want to point that out first of all. The miracle she needed didn't materialize until she took that first scary first step of faith. And it seems like a great story. It feels like it could just end here. The issue is it doesn't actually end here. It keeps going. And in fact, it takes a turn that you wouldn't expect it to. And this is one thing I love about the Bible. It actually is true to life. Like sometimes you're on the pinnacle and then the bottom drops out, right? And that's what happens in this story. Verse 17. There's not even any space here. It just flows right into it. Everything is great. Verse 17. Sometime later, the woman's son became sick. He grew worse and worse, and finally he died. Anybody else see that one coming? Like, why would God save this boy only to let him die a couple months later? Verse 18, it says, then the woman said to Elijah, "Oh man of God, what have you done to me? Have you come here just to point out my sins and kill my son?" I assume she probably said it with like tears in her eyes. Completely crushed, coming unraveled. And the truth of the matter was, Elijah didn't actually kill her son, right? But that's what it feels like to her. Because when we're in the midst of deep pain, we feel the need to hold somebody else responsible. It's your fault. If you wouldn't have come here, none of this would have happened. It was over. I'd already given up. I'd made peace with it. We're going to eat the cake and die. That was what was supposed to happen. We were okay with it. And then you showed up and you got my hopes up. You made me believe that like there was something more to keep living for. That things were going to be okay, but things are not okay. Like, why didn't you just leave us alone? Why did you interrupt what was happening? I feel like it would have almost been better just to have died than to have gotten my hopes up just to have them crushed. Verse 19 says, but Elijah replied, "Give me your son." And he took the child's body from her arms and he carried him upstairs to the room where he was staying and he laid the body on his bed. Did you catch that? Upstairs to his bed where he was staying. He's staying with these people. Maybe you're wondering, like, if this happened sometime later, which is months into the future, like, how is this guy who is just passing through, like, how could she just turn and talk to him when tragedy struck? Because he was living in their guest room now. Like, her generosity started with some water and some bread, and then it grew to offering him a place to live. And when this horrible thing happens, she has access to the one person she needs in the one moment she needs him. And so she hands her dead kid off to Elijah. And he carries this boy up to his room, sets him on the bed, and closes the door. Verse 20 says this. Then Elijah cried out to the Lord, "Oh Lord, my God, why have you brought tragedy to this widow who's opened her home to me and caused her son to die?" I wonder if this has ever happened to you before, like where someone in all kinds of pain asks you, like, why would God do this? and you're like a good Christian, so you're just like, you're trying to comfort them and calm them down and just try and like sit in the pain with them, and you're just like, oh, but God is good, whatever. And then like you get away from them where they're not in earshot anymore, and they're just like, God, why would you do this, right? It's such a human reaction. Verse 21, it says this, and he stretched himself out over the child three times, and he cried out to the Lord, oh, Lord, my God, please let this child's life return to him. And I'm just going to, just a freebie, I'm going to recommend that you don't lay on your bed on top of a dead kid and cry on him unless you're super sure that that's what God told you to do, okay? Because that is going to get you in trouble, okay? Yeah, just dug your dead kid up and laid on top of his body and cried with my door closed. Is that weird? You're going to jail, okay? Like that, you need to know that this is a specific, special instance where he felt like strongly that God told him to do this thing, okay? And so he says this, verse 22, the Lord heard Elijah's prayer and the life of the child returned and he revived. And then Elijah brought him down from the upper room and gave him to his mother. Look, he said, your son is alive. I want to know how he said that. There's a lot of exclamation points here. I like to think he was just like he wanted it to happen, but he kind of thought like, what if it doesn't happen? But then it did happen. Then he just like brought the kid downstairs and was like, boom, yeah, look at that. I mean, like when I took him upstairs, I was like, oh God, please let this happen. But like in the back of my mind, I was like, it's probably not going to. But then bam, right? Seriously, like he was dead, right? I mean, like he was like, oh, like, I mean, this is insane, okay? High fives, right? Why don't you make us some of those bread again? Like, let's get this thing going. That unending oil supply. Feeling excited. You know how to make cheesecake? Then verse 24, the woman said to Elijah, now I know for sure that you're a man of God and that the Lord truly speaks through you. Two miracles in, and this woman is just now starting to believe that God exists, okay? Really? He saved your life once and brought your kid back from the dead twice, okay? Like, and you're just getting to the place of like, okay, I'm willing to admit there might be something to this God thing, okay? But I'm no pushover, even though the jar of oil and flour miraculously filled itself for months and months on end, and my dead kid came back to life 2 days after he died. There's still a little doubt in my heart, which actually is a very human response, right? And here's the truth about us, all of us. We have a tremendous capacity to ignore the hand of God in our lives, all of us. We think, like, if God would just do something miraculous in my life, like, we could completely trust him. I mean, it would be easy to do whatever he asked me, like if I just saw him do something miraculous. And yet, some of us are just like this woman. We're several miracles deep with God, and we still harbor a lot of doubt as to whether or not he can actually be trusted. We also tend to write off miracles as something other than they really are. It's so easy to like see a miracle in somebody else's story, but then excuse the miracle in our story, right? We just think like, well, that was a coincidence. That was just happenstance. There's a perfectly logical explanation. Really? Magical flower lady? I mean, logical. Wait, maybe. Okay, sure. Maybe someone snuck in every single night for 5 months on end and filled the oil and the flour without anyone ever knowing it. Still, that's a pretty amazing thing, okay? Like, God somehow arranged this guy to, like, reverse burgle you every day. That still shows he's very invested in your life. I would still count that as a miracle personally, but like whatever you want to do, lady. No credit for that one, seriously? But here's the thing, God is incredibly patient as she slow grows into her faith, and he does the same thing for you too. And this is what I want you to think about when you look at this story. And I want you just to write this down. I don't think we have a slide for it. But here's what's true about this story. When you boil it down to its essence, at the end of the day, what saved this widow's family was a single, uncomfortable act of generosity. What saved this widow's family was a single, uncomfortable act of generosity. She stretched her faith and gave what she had, and then she discovered she had more than she thought she did. And she kept giving and kept giving, having no idea when she made this guy bread months earlier that she would need him later to resurrect her son. But God knew that. How could I say that? Because if you rewind to the beginning of the story, you see that God tells Elijah to go to this specific city and find this specific woman and challenge her to an act of incredible generosity. You see, the truth of the matter is, God had begun to answer this woman's prayer before she even knew she needed to pray it. This is how much your God loves you. This is how much he can be trusted. This is how much he wants things to work out for your good in life. And he sets her on this path to participate in her own miracle in ways she doesn't even realize are connected yet. She thought God asking her to give her last morsel of bread to this man, she thought that that was something that was moving her away from what it is she needed, but it was actually moving her toward it. And the same is true for you. And yeah, God could do it differently. He could make this easier on you. But God is much more interested in taking you through a process that teaches you a principle than simply handing you a product. God is much more interested in taking you through a process that teaches you a principle than simply handing you a product. And I'll tell you that the miracle that God is setting up for you is so much bigger than what you hope it's going to be. Because you're a human, which means you think way too small for such a big God. He's four steps ahead. And sometimes our waiting to obey is simply delaying the miracle we're desperate for. We worry that God can't be trusted, but the only way to learn that we're wrong is to take a scary step of faith and just trust. I learned later that, like, as it turns out, my dad is not the biggest jerk in the world. I mean, top 10, but, like, not... Wait, no, I'm just kidding. See, the truth of the matter is... He was trying to instill some things in me. As it turns out, like, my dad was much more interested in taking me through a process that taught me a principle than simply handing over a product. And here's the truth. I appreciated that next car I bought more than any other car I've ever owned. Because I worked for it in one of the most desperate seasons of my life. I took better care of it. I also learned a lot about myself and my capacity. Things I didn't think I could do, I found myself able to do. I actually recovered faster because I had an incentive to push through the pain and learn to walk and to work again. I also learned a lot about what it was to lead people well, to lovingly challenge them to move forward. All lessons that my father was smart enough to know wouldn't come without a cost. The process taught me a principle. I ended up in the same place that I wanted to be. But the lesson I learned along the way by doing it his way was so much more valuable. You see, compassionate acts can appear callous if you can't comprehend the whole picture. Compassionate acts can appear callous if you can't comprehend the whole picture. And yet God can be trusted. He sees things that you don't see. And he can be trusted to take you where you need to go. Here's the thing in response. I have no doubt that there's probably people in this room, probably most of us in here, myself included, that are asking God to do something, and his answer to you is giving you something to do. And I just want to tell you that in the midst of that, like, confusing, almost borderline insulting moment, because this isn't your understanding of what compassion is. It feels a bit callous to you. The reason why God has done this isn't because he's mean or he's insensitive or he doesn't have your best interest at heart or he's trying to take advantage of you. It's none of these things. It's that he has the wisdom to know that the thing you're asking, the thing that you're asking for, the thing that he's asking you to give is the key to what he wants to give you. And if you step out in trust, you will be well on your way to what you wanted all along. I want to give you a very pointed challenge today as we conclude. And there's lots of ways to apply this message. And I hope that you listen to God's voice much louder than mine. I hope that you hear what he's asking you to do, not just what I'm saying to you this morning. But because this particular story has a lot to do with the resources that we have and the battle over that God has over our heart between our stuff and our Savior, I want to challenge you this morning to rethink how you think about your stuff. And here's what I want to challenge you to do. Maybe some of you in here this morning, you've never given anything before to the church. Everything that you have, you've kept for yourself. Everything that God has given you, you're thankful. But if you're honest, you also stockpile. And God is asking you to step into the process of surrender. And so wherever you are, I want to challenge you to move out of your comfort zone this morning and begin a process of giving that may be new or strange or uncomfortable to you. Because more important than your supply is acknowledging your supplier. That's where your trust ought to lie. And let me just give you some kind of bare bones baby steps that you may take today. If you've never given anything before, I want to encourage you this morning today to go from giving nothing to giving something. If you're a person that has given something every once in a while, you know, maybe if the message was a little extra funny, you'll throw in a tip, you know? That's worth $3. I want to encourage you to move from something to something more. And if you're at a place where, you know, you give kind of something and it's a decent thing, but it's not a consistent habit, it's not this first thing when you get your paycheck where you acknowledge that everything you have is God's and comes from God, that you don't need the supply because you have a relationship with the supplier, I want to encourage you maybe to step from like giving something more into tithing consistently. And maybe that's your life. Maybe like my wife and I, you have kind of stumbled on to like the goodness of online giving, where you can kind of set up this program where it automatically takes your paycheck and gives every single time your paycheck drops. But maybe God is saying to step above and beyond and to offer him something more. I don't know where you're at, but I do know this. When you offer God what you have now, he promises, he guarantees to take care of you later. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to have the ushers come out, and we're going to take up our offering right now. I think it's always best to just respond immediately when you hear a message. I think the longer you let time lag, the longer it takes for your heart to kind of harden and for you not to respond what God is asking you to do. And I just want to encourage you, wherever you're at, to take a small step of faith, like this widow, to take the little that you have and to give it back to God. Let me just pray for us, and then the ushers are going to take up the giving, and we're going to spend a few moments in worship. Father, I thank you so much for all of these people that you've brought together today. I thank you for this incredible church, for its openness, for its inclusive nature. God, I thank you for your presence in our lives. God, we have to admit that we have so much, that we have been incredibly blessed. And we just want to acknowledge in this moment that everything good that we have in life is because you gave it to us. God, there are needs in each and every one of our lives. There are probably moments, even recently, where we have reached out to you and said, God, I need you to give me this. And your response was, I would love to. I would love to supply your needs. Now I'm asking you to surrender what you have to me. And God, I pray that even though fear wants to cloud out this response, that you would give each and every one of us, God, the ability to take a step of faith today. Some of us from nothing to something. Some of us from something to something more. Some of us from something more to tithing consistently and making this church our church home and contributing on a consistent basis to its mission. And some of us giving above and beyond. God has blessed us so much. And we want to offer it back to him and say, God, do in someone else's life through this church, through this ministry, what you have done in mine. And God, I pray that as we are open-handed with all that you've given us, that we would display that we can be trusted with your gifts. And God, you would be so compelled to give us even more. We ask these things in your name, Father. Everybody said, amen.